From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
Yes, yes, yes. Welcome aboard. You are tuned in to the Mighty 90, Pacifica Radio in Houston, 90.1 FM. This is Open Journal. This is KPFT, and this is the Open Journal program. Welcome aboard. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. David Leslie is the executive director of Houston's recently reopened Rothko Chapel, the ecumenical sanctuary to spirituality, art, and human rights, where he has served for the past 5 years. Prior to that, he served for many years with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, Austin's Habitat for Humanity, and Interfaith Ministries of Greater Houston, among others. He has a history degree from UT Austin and a Master's of Divinity degree from Austin's Presbyterian Theological Seminary. He has an abiding concern for human rights and interfaith relations. Welcome back, David, and thank you for joining us on Open Journal.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, thank you for coming out of exile to join us. And we're so happy to see that the Rothko has returned. One of the articles I read in the Chronicle with you and Molly Glenser recently, you said you were attempting to reclaim a bit of the sanctity of the chapel in this new revision back to kind of its original conception. Is that about right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that for those who come and visit, I think you'll notice two things immediately. Number one is the outside, the landscape, the part of the open space of the chapel has been redone to really create a sense of demarcation between the street and then when you enter the chapel grounds. To some extent, moving from the profane to the sacred, from the street to something that's set aside, you know, for different kind of use. So that procession is really important. And then when you enter into the chapel, for those who have been before, in 1999, there was a pretty major renovation in which glass partitions were put in the foyer to help with humidity. And there was a big desk that had a little bit of commercial activity. All of that is gone now. So when you actually walk in, you walk into this very unobstructed foyer, which is, again, a way to kind of bring back that sanctity, the sense that, hey, you're coming. It's a moment to pause. It's a moment to take off your shoes, if that's your tradition, as you enter into a sacred space. And then when you enter into the sanctuary or the chapel proper, you will notice that what used to be there was a baffle that hung down into the room to help kind of mute the light that could be so intense in Houston without it. That is gone now. So you get this sense immediately of open space and engagement with the elements. It's really quite stunning, with this skylight that has these louvers to kind of give you a sense of, a little bit of shadowing, a little bit of muting the intense light, but you're really now interacting with art, with the building, with architecture, and with the sky and the clouds. And suddenly it's kind of a full comeback story of the full circle back to original intent. And it's, in that sense, it really is reclaiming the sacred by removing certain things that are somewhat impediments to that relationship of something very existential.
Mm-hmm. That's such a powerful word, like the original intent. Sometimes we mean well, and the functionality of all of it becomes a barrier to what the initial intent was. That is quite powerful. What started that conversation? How did you and your organization say, we need to go back to the core value system, because it was powerful as it was for those of us who had the opportunity and the fortune to go into the space. What sparked the change?
Yes, I think it's an interesting conversation between historicity and futurism, because to some extent, the conversation starts with, yes, an original intent, the idea that the way that the chapel functioned, operated, one on particularly a very cloudy day or something where it's very overcast, it's very difficult to see the artwork. And the Rothko Chapel is one complete piece of art. It's one artwork designed by Mark Rothko, Philip Johnson, and other architects. And for me personally, and I think for everybody, that with the way that the old presentation was, on a dark day, you just couldn't see the brushstrokes. You couldn't see the texture of the paintings. You couldn't see the artisan's craftspersonship in that sense, or craftsmanship in the case of Mark Rothko. And by doing that, you lose a lot of the humanity of the creative process. And so suddenly you've taken this out of being a very humanistic, very one-on-one kind of engagement. So that was part of the original intent. The other thing is, and we've talked about this before, I mean, the chapel is probably one of the most visited places in Houston. Sometimes not all Houstonians know about it, and we're working on that. But, you know, before the renovation, well over 100,000 people a year came from over 100 countries. And it's a place that we had to prepare the fact that those numbers not going down. I think it's both an interest in Mark Rothko's work specifically, but more importantly, I think, or equally importantly, I should say, is the idea about sacred spaces, spaces set aside. And that kind of pilgrimage just becomes more and more important, I think, in planning ahead to say, how do we welcome 150,000 people? How do we welcome growing numbers? So part of this work that we're doing is also about building some new buildings. You'll notice now there's a new, the new Suzanne Deal Booth Welcome House to welcome guests. And then in the next phase of this work, there'll be a new program center, which also allows us to do programming in new ways. Last night, we'll probably get to this, we had Charles Blow, New York Times columnist, talking about, is this a racial reckoning, the period that we're living in? His talk was fantastic, and it would have been very nice. It would be very nice to have the program building so the next day we could do trainings. We could bring in activists, and we could talk about what is, like, what do I need to do? What do we need to do as people to keep moving this dial on racial equity? So I think we are also, Stephanie, really thinking ahead about how do we continue to be able to serve this community in more creative and diverse kind of way. So again, it's that conversion of the historical moment with really thinking about the future.
That's wonderful.
So on a nuts and bolts kind of level, David, what is a visit to the chapel going to entail for those of us who haven't taken advantage of it yet here in its first week, having just recently reopened? You mentioned the new visitors intake center. Does one go there first, check in, get pooled together with a few people? Can you go in and stay and linger? Is it a short duration visits only, limited numbers at this point, and so forth? And then I had a follow-up question about the pandemic influence on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're one of the later art spiritual institutions public to open and reopen because of the pandemic. So a lot of time taken to make sure that the numbers seemed to be going in the right direction. We had all the protocols in place. So what entails right now is we ask people to go on our website, rothkochapel.org, and there'll be a pop-up to really reserve your space, to reserve a ticket. It's all, you know, free, no charge. And what we're doing is running 30-minute segments from 11 to 4. So you sign up for a 30-minute reservation. There's 15 people maximum in each sort of visitor flight, shall we say.
Okay.
And that way we are able to get people back into the chapel again. 30-minute visit. You can re-up if there's a space, come back again. But it's in Wednesday through Sunday. So 11 to 4, Wednesday through Sunday. The Welcome House, which also now functions as our gift shop bookstore, that's open to 11 to 5 on Wednesday through Sunday. And we're going to keep this process at least through mid to late October. Like I said, we just reopened on Thursday. So we really wanted to stair step this and really work out the kind of the processes as we're trying to meet that sense of open to all and at the same time being very wise within the context of the pandemic. So the grounds are open basically from dawn to dusk, and you know, people are already coming over before we open the chapel for picnics and meditation, writing music, playing music, you know, so though the grounds are open to all too. But I think this is a very a logical way, I think, to get back into serving the public, but doing it in a way that is safe, you know, for staff, visitors, and volunteers alike.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful.
You're tuned to the Open Journal on Pacifica Radio, KPFT in Houston. We are visiting with David Leslie, Executive Director of Houston's Rothko Chapel, recently reopened this past week. We thank you for tuning in and joining us. I'm Dwayne Bradley with Stephanie Coleman. David, just a follow-up question, pandemic related. How did the pandemic impact all of the new work going on, the reconstruction, the reopening, the programming, et cetera? And then kind of on a personal level, how have you been handling the pandemic, just as David Leslie, the human being?
So for the chapel, programmatically, what we're doing is offering the public programs this fall virtually. So you can go through our website, sign up, as normal you would normally do, and then you it's offered through Vimeo, and then you'll get a link, and it's one way to keep the programming going. And but again, we're not doing anything with crowds in the chapel at this point, but that's been very interesting because I'll give an example. We do these monthly meditations every month, part of the 12 Moments series, to introduce people to different religious spiritual practices. I would say on average, we might 30 to 50 people on a first Wednesday. We're now having 100, 150 people sign up for these. So the virtual has been interesting because it has also allowed us to spread our programming out to a broader constituency. So that's been challenging, but there's been a positive side to that. You know, the construction did go forward. We really relied on the expertise of the subs and the contractors to really be on top of it and control the way they worked within the pandemic. Then we were delayed for a while. We were ready to open earlier in the summer, but with the spikes in Houston, we kept it closed. And, you know, we were very fortunate. We were able to get payroll enhancement, you know, PPP loan that allowed us to keep staff on board. That was a very big concern because we knew we were going to open at some point and we didn't want to lose all the staff and then have to start all over again. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the operational mechanics. I think on a personal note, the piece that I'm aware of is, remember, this is all happening within the context of the murder and the killing of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, many, many other people. And the tension, the existential tension in our country right now is running very high. The uncertainty, do I have a job? Am I going to have health care? You know, we've got election season going and there's nothing harmonious about that. So, you know, all of these values and all the societal issues that the chapel would be addressing through our programming, you're kind of on hold for a minute. And it was very difficult in a way. I mean, we found ways to address some of this. We did some curated playlists, for example, on racial equity and justice over a 10-year period and curated that into a playlist so people could access it. We did that on healing when the COVID situation started. We went back into our archives and found programs that we thought might be helpful to people during this time of healthcare and life uncertainties. But that inability to just suddenly have a pop-up gathering, knowing that, hey, it is really important for us to be in community together, mm-hmm. and not just a virtual community. There is something about sharing the space together. That's been a little bit of a challenge. So, Dwayne, I would say that that's just sort of my walk through really the last 6 months, you know, and we've kids on the West Coast, one we haven't seen since January, haven't been in a restaurant since March, you know, so trying to practice the best practice we could do, also mindful that it's not just about me, but it's about my neighbor and what's my responsibility. And I think that's been, somebody used the term almost uber empathy, and that's kind of what we need right now. And so I hope that, you know, both personally and then at the chapel, we're kind of keeping that out there of that this is a time of connectionalism, greatly needed, not time of division and separatism, you know, so that's, we're trying to do our part, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think that is the human part that is really missing. And I have been a fan of the Rothko Chapel forever. I was fortunate to be an art major at HSPBA. So that was one of the mandatory experiences we would always go through. As you see the campus reopening, what would you want it to look like? I'm curious as to how the paintings, the humidity works with all of that and with all the people in the space. But if you can envision manifesting what the original intent was, what would that look like?
That's heavy. That's heavy on a Monday, isn't it? I would say that I'm going to give you a story, and it may not be exactly what you had in mind, but when I interviewed for the position in Houston, it was Martin Luther King Day 2015. Mm-hmm. And the chapel has a history, long history of on the actual holiday of broadcasting Dr. King's sermons and speeches throughout the day. So I went through my interview, and then I had a few, half hour to do something with. So I just sat on one of the benches by the old bamboo, you know, by the pool, and listened to these speeches. And I noticed that as I looked up, I saw people of all ages on the grounds just passing through, some sitting on a bench, some having a picnic, some going in the chapel. All races, religion, you could see hijab, you could see a turban, you knew that there was diversity, you know, right there on the grounds. You could see people come in and stay for a while and some just pop in and then leave. For a moment, that to me held the original intent, or that held what that purpose was. Mm-hmm. That there is something I found very interesting about the chapel is that we're not prescriptive, we're not a congregation. We don't have a defined theology in that way. So we oftentimes think about people just being there doing their own thing, you know, individuals doing their own spiritual journey. But as I sat there, and now my over 5 years of being intimately involved with the chapel, it is quite a community. It's quite a connected group of people because something is drawing them to that place. Mm-hmm. And we may have different ways we articulate it, but there is something deep in common, you know, and you know enough about the chapel to know that there's this interesting interplay juxtaposition between the interior of the chapel, which let's just say is that inner transformation. And then as you come out, you're seeing Barnett Newman's broken obelisk dedicated to the life and legacy of Dr. King. Mm-hmm. So there is this, we use the word, I'm using the word pilgrimage a lot these days because it could be the art pilgrim. It could be a spiritual seeker. It could be somebody who just needs a reminder, a boost that, hey, I got to get out there and do another day on the social justice front. Right. But they're all connected. There's this connection. And so that was my story that I keep thinking about because for me, that sort of captured in a moment what I think the part of that deep intent of what the chapel is about, right? Sharing our individuality, but within a sense of universality.
Yeah. Now, and that, you know, it's really amazing you say that because even to watch Houston evolve as a more diverse city, from what recent reports say, the most diverse city in the nation, and how it does that without being segregated, which is the mm-hmm. other title that it has challenges with. The Rothko Chapel seems to be a wonderful space that for however you've done it, that has not been the space where that lives out, that type of cultural dividedness, that people have received that as a part of its core mission. How do you think the Rothko Chapel has played in either helping to shape that diversity in Houston or supporting that diversity in Houston from where we were as a city 50 years ago?
Well, I think with the founders, John and Dominic DeMunnell, had an amazing sense of their own self, who were never complete without the sense of somebody else's strong sense of self. Mm-hmm. So they also had this amazing curiosity and how the world works and how people think and what we believe, which led them then to, I think, be vulnerable, which meant that they were willing to put themselves out, not as the star, but as somebody as a seeker. Mm-hmm. And I think we need more of that. You know, I think that, you know, that somewhat, you know, we use it too quickly. It's not about the answer. It's about the question. It's not about the destination. It's about the journey. And those can be quips and they can be just throwaway lines, but they also can be deeply profound. And I think that's what we really need, because as you note, Houston has that double identity, right? Most diverse on one hand and most segregated at the same time.
Yeah.
And so places like the Rothko Chapel, and there are other places in the city and around the world that look, at least we put that out as aspiration. Right. You know, and then we, as long as we keep that out there and we're willing to be publicly held accountable to it, and we keep living into that horizon, then I think we're serving, you know, I think we're doing something. And we through this pandemic, and as we talked about earlier, with the Black Lives Matter movement and then, you know, the struggles that we have, part of the reason going back into our archives was to do two things. One was to lift up what we had done. The second was to find out what we hadn't done. Because I think it can be very easy to pat yourself on the back and then just go on. Or there's another sense to say, hey, you know, it's not who's at the table, who's not at the table is really the important question. And we're spending a lot of time in metrics. You know, those metrics can be kind of overwhelming, but really looking at who is visiting, what zip codes in the city are represented by our visitors, what's the age of our, what's the demographics, how many young people do we have as presenters and program leaders? So I really think that that's ingrained at the very beginning of this journey for the Rothko Chapel. And it's really cool today to have colleagues and staff colleagues and volunteers that keep pushing those boundaries, right? And to me, that bodes well for the future of the Rothko Chapel, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So David, I know last week you had the 6th annual Farenthold Lecture featuring the amazing op-ed columnist from the New York Times, Charles Blow, along with Melanie Lawson, and some interactivity via Zoom with questions from folks like ourselves who are watching. Very powerful conversation, a great lecture that he gave addressing a lot of these issues related to the necessary reckoning related to racism that's ongoing in America and the challenges that that has posed, particularly to moderate and semi-liberal white people. A quick comment on that from you, perhaps, and for folks who missed it, how would they find that, and how can they find all of the things, including ways that they can support the Rothko Chapel, because it's all free?
Yeah, so let's go to the latter, if you don't mind, first, just to get that, because it's important, because we want people to access what we have. It's just go again to our website, rothkochapel.org. And for all of our previous programs, we have a link drop down archives. And then you hit that, you can search it by topic, you can search it by year. And that's a great way to be able to, you know, access Charles's program last week, as well as anything that's in our archives. And also, we do have that Donate Now page link too, so you can support the chapel that way. And we always are grateful for donations. I mean, it's like KPFT. We've got to have them to keep going. I think that Charles's lecture was very, very interesting. And again, sort of like we were talking today, this importance of history and the importance of what you're going to do in the future, tomorrow, today, this afternoon. I mean, his address really posed a very, very big challenge to us, which is these moments like end of slavery, Reconstruction, the Civil Rights Act. You know, you go down the list of these moments, which he are calling racial reckoning, where there seems to be a moment of hope. But how quickly, he said, white backlash tends to follow. It doesn't take long for that moment of hope to turn to anger or despair. And the question is, we come through a summer, which he argued last night, that because of the pandemic, there were people had a lot of time on their hands. Yeah. that they don't usually have, and they were looking for things to do, so they all pour out in the street, like 60,000-70,000 downtown Houston, right after the killing of Mr. Floyd. And then the question is there really staying power? Is that really a connecting moment that will transcend time? Will it build alliances? And that's really what kind of what we're left with, right? And that sense of, he used the word privilege a lot. What are we willing to give up? And I think these are things that I really think we are really left with, challenged by, because it is, do we see the moment or do we quickly revert to what we were doing the day before, the year before? And I was left with a lot of, I mean, I think there were some really challenging questions that came out of that too, particularly for white liberal, good, as he wrote in one of his columns, you know, good people, and why do good people sometimes do bad things? And part of bad things is just neglect. So he's a columnist, so he left this as a good columnist does, with some very profound challenges. And when he was pressed to answer him, he said, I don't know if I have the answers, but you probably would say, I'll write another column.
Well, David Leslie, we thank you so much for joining us on Open Journal. Look forward to seeing you and the programs at Rothko Chapel here. Happy that it's reopened and happy that you had time to join us on this In Exile edition of Open Journal.
Thank you very much.
It's time to wrap this edition of Open Journal. Check the archive at kpft.org and subscribe to our podcast, please, KPFTOJ. And thanks to anyone who has subscribed and donated to KPFT, particular to Open Journal. Thanks for your support. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. As always, we are a dedicated all-volunteer production staff, including Rick Campbell, Susan Phillips, and Maverick. Open Journal theme music provided by Kevin McLeod. Thank you for listening and thank you for your support.
And as always, we like to leave you with a thought to carry you through the week. This comes from our recently birthdayed 96-year-old former president, Jimmy Carter, who said, "Aggression unopposed becomes a contagious disease." Take care of each other.